Cooling Radio.
Global Cooling Radio.
A production of ClimateGateCountryClub.com.
The world's largest networking site for skeptics.
Joanne, welcome to the show. You've worked extensively with children. You had your own television series called Why, and you've had radio and television appearances too numerous to mention. But the reason we have you here today is because at one time you were, in fact, a devout believer in anthropogenic global warming, and after doing a little investigating, you became a skeptic, a rather vocal one, so much so that you've written a book called The Skeptic's Handbook, which I believe has been printed out in over 150,000 copies, have been sold, and it's now been translated into 13 languages. Is that correct?
It is. It is. The volunteers come out of nowhere and they send me a copy and say, hi, here's the Portuguese translation. Is this okay? Can I put this up on my blog?
Well, it's great that you're getting people from around the world who are so excited about it that they're willing to translate it for free. As you know, I do have all 13 editions on my website, so I've been very impressed with it. And let me just say this. If I had to give anybody advice out there that was looking for a starting point on learning about global warming and digging into this matter, I would have to think your Skeptic's Handbook would be it.
Well, thank you, Mark. That's very high praise, and thanks for helping to spread the word about the Skeptic's Handbook. It was something that I did pro bono, I guess, because as a science communicator, which is my training to communicate science, so science first and then the specialty of communicating science. And it sounds like such an esoteric, kind of odd, quirky job, but I think it's really central to what's happened in the last 10 or 20 years. And unfortunately, science communicators have really let us down. And when it became clear to me 3 years ago just how different the real story was from the story that was being put out, I guess press releases, cut and pasted and put into newspapers instead of being analysed and interpreted as a journalist ought to, that's when I thought I really had to do something. And that's why I put the Skeptic's Handbook together, because having been to Bali for the UN FCCC conference, I was just staggered to see how big and how clear the arguments were that weren't getting a run.
Well, I've got to tell you, anytime you dare to question the arguments that the others are making, though, you're called a shill for big oil or for coal or for, you know, I mean, essentially you're a pawn for big business. And I think
a denier, Mark, a denier.
A denier, yes.
I feel strongly about that. I think we need to stand up and call them bullies every time they use the word denier. It's baseless name-calling. My tactic on my blog is to say to anyone who uses the term against us as an insult that they need to name and explain the evidence that we deny. And they can't. Not one yet. A few have tried and they've put forward some evidence. And I guess they've either had to concede that we could discuss that evidence and we could either find flaws in it and there was a point to discuss, or they need to apologise and say, well, okay, obviously it's not appropriate. We'll go back to calling you scientists or skeptics or some other polite term instead of denier. And we really need to put our foot down about this, because without polite discussion, we can't talk science.
Well, I agree, and I think it's interesting, and I think you saw me getting beat up out there a little bit in one of the science blogs, but it's...
You fight so well, Mark. You fight so well in some of the dirtiest playgrounds.
I do. In fact, I thought that was one of the best ways to learn was to go into these sites, but unfortunately, all they want to do is, you know, challenge Lord Monckton's peerage and talk about how much funding ExxonMobil has spent. And speaking of funding, if we could just dive into that for a little bit, you know that in the last week or so, the Coke industry thing has hit. So now Coke Industries has picked up where ExxonMobil has left off, and therefore every single bit of skeptic evidence out there has been produced by Coke Industry or with funding from Coke Industry, and therefore everything that's been on the skeptic side is not valid because of the funding. So talk to me about the money, because we didn't mention it up front, but one of the things that you've also put out is a very fine paper called Climate Money. So talk to us about the money on the other side, because the mainstream media, at least in America, always wants to talk about the money on the skeptic side, but they never want to follow the money on the other side. So talk to me about the money on the green side.
It's curious, isn't it? I put that paper out in July last year called Climate Money, and it added up the amount of money that was spent by the U.S. government on climate science-related research and technology. And it also looked at the funding for the carbon credits, the giant carbon market, which is such a small market now compared to what it wants to be, what they hope it will become. And I put those numbers out, and I was shell-shocked in a way that no one else had done that kind of research and put those numbers together. But, of course, well, no one's being paid to come up with that kind of information, are they?
No.
So that had a real impact, and it's taken them 6 months to come out with a reply. And what was the funding that they come up with? Something like 70-something-odd million dollars extra they've finally found paid the skeptics, which is still pipsqueak nothingness compared to what the US government has paid to climate science researchers and the climate industry, as I call it, because that totaled something like $79 billion over the last 20 years. So looking from 1989 through till 2009, funding for strict science research, including NASA and satellites and other things, and also funding for climate technology, which is clean, green, renewables, poking carbon dioxide underground and pumping it into holes and things like that, came to $79 billion. The total funding that Greenpeace came, and I Googled and I searched, Greenpeace had the biggest number of anyone in terms of research of funding towards skeptics, and that added up to all of $23 million. So it's taken them another 5 months to find what? Another $70 million? It's still nothing. Where are the grants I can apply to if I was a skeptical researcher and I wanted to apply for grants that were for expensive equipment to do satellite recordings or tests at CERN, which is the big collider in the middle of Europe? It costs, you know, millions of dollars every time you use it. Where's the funding to do that kind of research, the grants to have staff, to have a PR department? I think, yeah, it's a joke. The funding's about 3,500 to 1, and that was not adjusted for inflation. That did not include funding from other governments or from private industries. That was only the U.S. government.
Wow. So you're basically telling me then that money coming from the government to fund research might have strings attached, and that if someone were openly a skeptic, that they might find their chances at gaining a government grant here in the United States a bit diminished because of their point of view?
Well, look, those kind of situations have been documented. The skeptics who've been sacked, and there have been several of them who've lost their jobs due to being skeptics. I mean, a few others like Lindzen and Spencer, who do great work, are still doing the jobs they were doing effectively 20 years ago. So they haven't sacked all the skeptics. But very little funding gets through to skeptical researchers. Some skeptical researchers just get their jobs chopped out completely. But basically, even without any dishonest, you know, sacking people component, it doesn't matter. No one is being paid to audit the IPCC. No one is being paid to go through and check the numbers the other way. It's in no one's advantage and interest to find holes in the big theory. And that's why it's been left to climate bloggers, the retired scientists who've come out of nothingness to find giant holes in the theories put forward by the IPCC, in their numbers, in their data, in their graphs. And that's amazing. This is a real sociological phenomenon we haven't seen before, where these retired scientists have come out as volunteers and they're doing the work of $4 billion agencies like NOAA, checking the station sightings and things like that. Anthony Watts' great work, which you would know all about.
Oh, yes.
And, you know, it boggles the mind that we need retired bloggers, retired scientists to come out and find the holes in an agency that has $4 billion worth of funding each year. They can't check the sighting of their own thermometers and make sure they're in the right spot.
Well, I would argue that anybody that comes out as a skeptic might find themselves a retired scientist rather quickly. So maybe that's why it works that way.
There is an element to that too. I mean, people like Bob Carter, who's a professor in Australia, he said to me, I guess it's more of a roundabout way, that he just found universities had become so hierarchical that you had to play that management game. And that he wanted to do the research. He wanted to get into the numbers and do the data and not play those kind of politics and games and whatnot. So it was easier, without being forced out of the system, it's just easier to get out of the system and become your own self-sufficient kind of research machine.
You must have enjoyed Bill Clinton's comment a couple of weeks ago when he was giving a presentation on the first day of spring, and he said, it's a pleasure to be here with you on the first day of spring, or as Al Gore would call it, proof of global warming. So I thought that was hilarious that even Bill Clinton had to take a shot at Al Gore on this issue. Hey, listen, we have a caller and from New Orleans, and let's go ahead. I believe the name is Layton, and let's see if we can bring them on.
Yes, this is Layton Stewart. Hi, Joanne. I have a question relative to models. Have you found a really good reference on all of the different assumptions that a modeler has to choose from to put these complex models together? Because what I would like to do is either find that reference or maybe even myself put together a list of all of these assumptions and even the ranges of choices they have with these assumptions that show that they can build anything they either consciously or subconsciously want to create.
Right, I haven't seen anything like that, and it would be good to have it. Because I'm married to a modeler, I understand very well what you're talking about. The way people can make small adjustments and assumptions to tweak the output, to get the output to agree with some line on a graph that they want it to agree with. And if you adjust the right assumptions, some of those assumptions become multiplied and factored through in so many ways inside there that sometimes a very small change can make a very big difference in the output. And I'd like to see a list like that. It would be good if we can help the public understand why modeling is so not evidence. It is important to science, but it is not evidence.
Bill Jones admitted that they may have used a sensitivity factor that was too strong for the Earth. And, of course, that sensitivity factor alone can drive those models to the catastrophic results that they get.
The sensitivity factor is what it's all about. And to put this in perspective, there is one really key flaw, which I think everyone who feels strongly about this ought to know, and that is the one about the missing hotspot. Now, Layton, have you heard of that before, the missing hotspot?
Oh, yes. I use it in my talks, and I do.
Oh, good, good.
Are you going
because
to present at the Fourth International Climate Conference? In Chicago?
Oh, I would love to. I would love to, but unfortunately it's very difficult for me to get all the way from Australia to New York. I had a fantastic time at last year's Heartland Conference. Good on them for doing another one. Oh, well, might have to wait till next year. But the missing hotspot, I think, is the key flaw people need to understand. The way that the models, all the stuff people talk about with evidence for carbon, this is another example of conflation. When they say, oh, there's evidence for 100 years that carbon causes warming, there is, and we can go back to the spectroscopic information and say, well, it causes about 1 degree of warming every time carbon doubles. I know these numbers all sound hard on radio, but bear with me. Most of the models suggest we'll get between 2 degrees and 11 degrees of warming. And everything above 1 degree of warming is due to these feedback factors, which are not carbon. They're things like cloud changes and humidity changes and the way ice changes, it's reflecting the light off the planet. All of these other factors, and the big ones are cloud and humidity, are what make the warming from 1 degree up to anything up to 11 degrees. So all these models disagree with each other, and the average comes out at about 3.5 degrees. But once you get a grip on the fact that the feedback factors have no evidence for them, then the debate starts to get much more serious. We can really focus in. We can wipe out all that other evidence people say, you know, the Arrhenius equations, the Tyndall, the spectroscopic stuff, and say, yes, well, you know, it's only 1 degree of warming that we get from carbon if it doubles. And that's from 1780, the year, 1780 till 2070 or whenever we hit a doubling point. It's only a degree and we've done most of that. The really significant stuff is in the feedback, and people need to understand that the models have assumed that feedback is positive. And that's an assumption which is huge, and they've built it in lots of different ways, but there is no empirical evidence. There are no measurements from the planet that tell us that the feedback is positive and is strongly positive, and indeed there's a lot of evidence from the planet that suggests it's negative.
Correct.
It just wipes out the warming, wipes out the disaster, and wipes out the catastrophe. And if there's one point I really want to get across to people, it's about those feedback factors which are not backed up by evidence.
Absolutely. I agree. Thank you very much.
Thank you for calling in, Leighton. When you look at the carbon trading scheme that they've proposed for, you know, the cap and trade in America, for instance, one of the first questions that jumps into my head as a layperson is, well, gee, if carbon's so bad, or if carbon dioxide is so bad, even though a lot of people confuse it with carbon monoxide, if carbon dioxide is so bad, then why doesn't the government just do a straight tax? And I think the answer is then people like Al Gore and a bunch of bankers and carbon traders wouldn't get wealthy. Is there another reason why they think that system would work better than just a straight carbon tax?
Because they kid themselves that it's got something to do with the free market. This is another one that I think all of us who are skeptical need to pocket this line, learn this by rote. We need to all learn the numbers, the dollars behind it, and we also need to understand to rebut the idea that this is a free market. There is nothing free about a market in carbon. It's based on a permit that's issued by governments or government agencies or people approved by the government to issue these permits. It has nothing to do with a free market, because how much would you pay for air over China that might have had more carbon in it if someone had have made a different decision? How much would you outlay out of your wallet to own that air or the right to that air? It's not even owning air. It's nothing as solid as air. It's the right to something. And this is the thing. It's a permit. It's a license. It's not a free market at all. If the government didn't force us at the point of a gun to buy a carbon credit, who would buy one?
I don't think I would.
A few people would who want to pretend
that
they're, you know, going to die saving the planet kind of thing, and I'm more holy than you. They would do it as a PR exercise. No one actually wants to own that permit for anything that's useful to them outside of a PR exercise, or because the government is holding a gun to their head saying, do this or you'll go to jail. So it's not a free market, and this is the big lie put forward by the green side of the spectrum, and the people who say that it's got anything to do with the free market are only people who don't know what a free market is. So we need to kill that one off straight away. It's nothing to do with the free market. It's a forced market.
Joanne, I'm making a note. Al Gore is not a free market environmentalist. I'm putting it down right now.
It's a fixed market, damn it. It's a forced market.
We have actually less than 1 minute of official time left.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, that's okay, though. We're going to... Most of the listenership comes through the archive, and with that in mind, because we had a little technical glitch at the beginning, I'm wondering if we might be able to run about 5 or so minutes over with you, and then I can edit the whole thing in Audacity, re-upload it, and no one listening in the archive will ever know we had a problem.
Oh, sounds good to me, because there's another line I was going to mention about the other things skeptics need to know. Last year, carbon trading worldwide was $130 billion.
Wow.
That is a small market compared to what it would be if they get their dreams and they get a U.S. market, a Canadian market, an Australian market, a Chinese, you name it, the world. It really has to be a world market to work. If they do that, we're talking a $2 trillion market or more.
Wow.
I mean, the money that goes in there is just huge. They're talking about being the largest commodity traded worldwide. And if I want to explain to people or just open their eyes to the other possibilities, it takes only 6 words. I just say, banks want us to trade carbon. Think about it. There are people sitting next to me on the plane. They kind of say, yeah, banks want us. And you can see the cogs are ticking. And I'm saying, Goldman Sachs wants you to trade carbon. JP Morgan wants you to trade carbon. So does Deutsche Bank, HSBC. Barclays Bank. I can list them all off.
Okay, we've just went into archives. We've just gone into the archive footage, which means we're not live now. But
we can edit. That's fine.
We are going to edit, and then everyone who hears the archive version is going to hear everything that we're saying right now. Now, one of the things that you mentioned in your handbook is there's a reference to the precautionary principle, and you see this being thrown around all the time by the people who are on Mean Green's team. And I still recall with great detail Ed Begley Jr. being interviewed by Stuart Varney, and the thing got pretty heated, and Ed Begley said, well, this is insurance. Don't you have insurance on your home? This is like insurance. And my thought was, well, that's true, but when I buy insurance for my house, people in Mexico don't riot because they can no longer afford corn tortillas. And I think my reasoning there is that the precautionary principle that these guys are throwing around naively assumes that they're not causing any damage now. And, of course, I'm going to have Ann McElhaney on next week, and we'll talk about even more a lot of the damage being done. But give me your assessment. What is some of the harm that is coming from this global warming hysteria right now?
Well, yeah, firstly, I want to point out that the precautionary principle is not a principle that means anything. It's not a principle like, name some laws of physics or something, principles that matter. It's not that kind of principle. It's a simple, it's a PR invention. And the precautionary principle, you know it's based because it works both ways. We could just as easily say, well, we should use precaution before we trash our global economies based on something that has no evidence to support it, shouldn't we? So the precautionary principle, because it works both ways, makes it utterly useless, in a sense, for deciding anything. But it's a great PR slogan, and they do use it all the time. You're quite right about the house insurance. The harm from this is that we feed money through to the class of people who we don't vote for, we don't elect, and we don't audit, namely the UN. And they talk about a Tobin tax or the Robin Hood tax. That's starting to do the rounds now, the idea of, you know, a tiny tax on Forex schemes. How could that hurt anyone? It's only on Forex speculative traders and whatnot. But the answer is they're talking $400 billion a year being drawn out of the global economy and given to some UN agency to spend on, you know, helping people. Given the UN's record for actually helping people, I would, you know, question why they deserve to get it. But I really fear that what we're doing with that is taking money, because who pays for it but us? Ultimately, it's coming from the consumer. Money is, it comes somehow or another through the costs we pay on transport, on things, on our banking deals, on all of those, or our, you know, reduced profits when we're stockholders buying shares. It comes from us, and it goes as more money to UN bureaucrats who are not elected, who are not accountable, who are not auditable, and who can spend it employing their friends to run giant PR campaigns to scare us about the next thing. And that I find quite scary. But it hurts the poor, and that's something that a lot of people don't seem to understand with this issue. When we make energy more expensive, the people who it hurts the most are the people who desperately need energy in order to get the kind of lifestyles we take for granted. And they worry about population in Africa. But if there are little kids out there, and it costs a bit more to freeze meat and bring it to a market, those kids on the borderline will miss out on getting meat when they're eating their diet. So they get vitamin A deficiency or zinc deficiency or iron deficiency, so they get sick from diseases. Some of those kids will die because they didn't get those extra nutrients. I mean, it really does come down to life and death for people on the breadline in Africa and poor countries. They need cheap energy in order to get healthy food, to keep their vaccines refrigerated, to get medicines that are also refrigerated, to have cars to get to school, all of these things. And that, to me, is where the real pain comes from the green delusions about why we need to cut back on our carbon.
If I could think of one profession that just has an almost sacred trust, it would be teachers with the students. And so when we have these young people who are in schools that are teaching the Al Gore side of the argument almost exclusively, how does a parent talk to a child about global warming and the lack of a need to be fearful and to stay up at night having bad dreams and so forth in a way that doesn't necessarily bring down the teacher in the eyes of the student?
Oh, Mark, and you want me to do this in how long?
you can take as long as you want.
Mark, you're asking really difficult questions. It's a good question. I have small children myself. I don't know that there is an easy answer to that, to get the kids to still have that respect that you want them to have for their teachers. I sympathize with the teachers. I mean, the teachers are good people, but a lot of them have come from school to college and university and back to school. And they're given curriculums where they don't have control necessarily over the big picture and the things that they want to do. And they're also given $1 billion worth of propaganda, colour pictures and full glossy brochures and movies and documentaries and you name it to support the other side of the story. And so, I guess, as I said, there's no easy answers on this one. I just wish that, I think if parents point out to children that there is another side to the story, and that the people in the government want to have more money to tax to build their own departments up, and that honest scientists do the research that they're paid to do, and they are paid to find a scare, then it's not so much a question of people being naughty or nasty or evil. It's honest scientists and honest teachers, but the system is broken. The scientific system is broken, the media system is broken, and our educational system needs a fair bit of work. Does that help? Does that make sense?
Oh, it does, and I can tell you that I just think the biggest part of all this is that at a very early age, teachers begin inculcating in children the idea that we have to give back. We have to be good citizens of planet Earth. And I can remember, you know, back in the 70s, going around and picking up cans and recycling aluminum and picking up the plastic, you know, water bottles everywhere and saving those and recycling them. And really at the end of a Saturday afternoon doing that, feeling like I had really done something good. And I think that's a big part of this. The world's in trouble and we're going to go save it. I think that's a huge part of it, but then again, nobody's thinking about all the countries that aren't getting access to the same low-cost electricity that those of us in the developed world have. And frankly, we wouldn't be where we are today without, you know, low-cost electricity. No one thinks about those people suffering. Nobody thinks about the fact that when the price of corn doubles, you know, on a global scale, that's an inconvenience, as Lord Monckton said once, to those of us who have a good job. But to someone like you said in a third world country, I mean, that's the difference between eating and not eating. I mean, it's so I don't think anybody is thinking past the point of, hey, I'm trying to save the planet from pollution. I think
we can tap into that. As I said, you know, people are basically good people and they want to do the right thing. And that includes a lot of the scientists who are working on these things as well. I think we can tap into that by changing the good things that we want them to work for. And instead of focusing on, and there's nothing wrong with recycling, you know, putting your paper in and your tin cans and whatnot, but we can focus them on the bigger picture things that we need to fight for, the things that are really special, democracy and freedom and logic and reason, and the things that lifted us out of the dark Stone Age times, the things that really set us apart, our rule of law, those kind of things, to get people to pay attention to what our bureaucrats are doing with our money. And it's difficult when talking about children, but I think those are the kind of things we need people to feel good about writing letters to their members, to their elected representatives, to point out some of the problems. And parents can also print off the Skeptics Handbook, which is for free, as you said, on your site or my site. And or they can write to Heartland and get a copy of it, or email me and we can arrange copies that are already full-colour printed ones. And they can give them to the teacher of the children's class. Now, you might get lucky or you might not. I'm not saying it's a guaranteed recipe for success. But I know some teachers are certainly open to hearing the other side of the story. As I said, especially when you say banks want us to trade carbon. Even the most greenest of green people will stop in their tracks when you point out that the big pushers behind this are Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, Barclays, but yeah, you list them off. That'll slow them down. If nothing else, it might take some of the confidence and the zeal out of the statements. But for some teachers, it will definitely help them to open their eyes and look the other way. And for ones who are partly skeptical but quiet, it'll give them the license to stand up and tell everyone that actually there is another side of the story. Why don't we discuss both sides in the class?
I would like to see that happen, and I would like to see the Skeptics Handbook in every classroom, I started to say in America, but really around the globe, especially anywhere that Al Gore's An Inconvenient Truth is being shown with or without its warning labels. When you hear people talk about carbon dioxide and they refer to it as pollution, what's the first thought that goes through your head?
that nearly everything you eat in your kitchen, nearly everything in that cupboard has come from carbon dioxide. The only two things that you put on the dinner table that are not coming directly from carbon dioxide through some form or another is salt, table salt, and water. Everything else, all the food you eat, everything organic, was once carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Plants suck it out of the atmosphere and turn it into plant. Animals eat the plant, so whether it's meat, whether it's milk, whether it's eggs, no matter what it is, if it's got carbohydrate in it, it's organic. It's carbon trading, $130 billion every year. surely we can do a lot more with that than what we're doing, and that is a really serious cost when we say, what's the harm in cutting back carbon? The harm is kids go blind who could have seen, kids die of diarrhea that could have been saved, and that's the cost. It's life and death.
When you look at the history of Greenpeace, eventually it was hijacked by political activists. Do you think one of the problems right now is that we really don't have a place for people who are interested in helping planet Earth, being good citizens of planet Earth? We really don't have an organization for them to be part of that isn't also espousing this anthropogenic global warming theory. I mean, do you think it would be possible to set up an organization that plants trees and cleans up trash and does everything it can for clean air and clean water without that organization being hijacked by, I guess, what Chris Horner likes to call the Greens, and have them again start pushing the global warming theory? I feel like a lot of these people who just want to be good citizens of planet Earth don't have any place else to go.
It's true. I'd love to see it happen. I'd like to donate money to groups who wanted to, say, get vitamins to people, say, pregnant women in the third world so their kids had a half a chance before they were born. Mm. I mean, good food is even better, but, vitamins are so cheap. I'd love to see something like that happen, but I think at the moment we need to solve a broader problem than that. If the media still is not reporting the news properly, being investigative, giving us both sides of the story, I think we'll just see a repeat. An organisation which starts off with good intentions becomes big and powerful. Before you know it, those who are good at playing the big and powerful game, the apparatchik deal, the marketing strategies and whatnot, they infiltrate the organisation. The organisation gets sidetracked and it becomes sponsored by giant groups like the Rockefellers and Wall Street and, just another Greenpeace. So without that media protection, with real investigative reporting, I don't see how we could maintain an organisation that we could trust in the long run. And the media has been so poor at reporting how Greenpeace has changed and transformed itself compared to what it used to be.
Well, in the U.S., a number of people in the media have said they don't feel an obligation to report both sides of the study. I can't remember the gentleman on 60 Minutes who felt that there was no obligation to report both sides. And, of course, we're the deniers, and they have us lumped in the same category as, people who don't believe that the Holocaust took place and people who don't believe that man landed on the moon. So they, at least initially, being Team Green, had done a great job of stereotyping anyone who disagreed with anthropogenic global warming as being some kind of a crackpot or someone who was a shill for big oil or big coal or whatever. So we haven't gotten anywhere close to the, from what you're telling me, you're starting to get some fair media coverage, but it's just not happening, in the United States. We have Fox News, we have talk radio, and, that's really about it. I mean, all of the mainstream television. I mean, look who owns three major television networks here in the United States, General Electric. I mean, when it becomes time to retrofit your house with modern appliances so you can pass the Obama energy audit, who's going to sell you those appliances? I mean, I don't see any of those. And again, nobody wants to follow that money chain.
Not just the profits for GE, but follow who owns GE, who are the major stockholders for GE. Because when you do that, you often find out that they're just the large financial institutions themselves who really want carbon trading to happen. So you follow the money, but keep following it because
it keeps going,
and it usually ends up back at the banks and financial houses.
Well, if public opinion polls mean anything, it seems like the general public in America is starting to, shall we say, smell the green poop on Al Gore's shoes. They know something's up. They may not know why they don't believe, but they do know that there's something that just doesn't smell right about this whole global warming theory. And a lot of us who are old enough to remember killer bees and Y2K and, what else, the acid rain, and you could just go on and on with all the things. And
DDT,
and we've got water bottles, they're floating trial balloons right now with water bottles, bottled water, I should say. So it seems like the whole time I've been on the planet, Joanne, there's been one scare after another, and none of them have ever come about. I know I'm leaving some out. I'm trying hard to. I know I'm.
There have been real scares, and they they were important, but differentiating between the real ones and the fake ones is really important. And you're right, people have been doing it, and I believe, go back to witch doctors, because this is something straight out of the witch doctor handbook. If where you stand up and announce there's going to be really bad storms unless you send me your best three kind of, you know, brides, and I'll have them, thank you. And guys have been doing this since humans were human. It's been going on time immemorial. It's a very old recipe for power, success, glory, and status, and now money.
Well, Joanne, I want to thank you for being here today. We've gone over. We're still new, still growing every week. Congratulations on being featured.
Thank you. Yeah, no, good on you. And I think what you're doing also is really important, because we need to copy the things the Greens and the others do well. And I'm speaking to someone who used to be a Green. And there are things they do really well. Science and logic and reason is not one of them. But they do communications, they do networking, they do marketing, they do those things well. And we have often been guilty of not simplifying our messages well enough to come up with the bumper sticker, you know, the idea like, this is not a free market, this is a fixed market, and things like that. To make it really simple, because people don't have time. And that's where doing what you're doing, and also, I guess, editing down things like this radio interview, the shorter you can make it, the better. It's really hard as a communicator. I always say this. It's really hard to be brief.
Well, I think we've been on for an hour now. You really need to, it's very late where you are, so thank you for staying up.
Good.
Thank you once again for being here. The name of the handbook is the Skeptics Handbook. You can download it. Give me your web address.
joannenova.com.au.
Fantastic. Or you can come to hooterville.gazette.com/joannenova, and that actually takes them back to your site. I'm not trying to steal traffic from you. So go to either site, but absolutely recommend it. And again, now in 13 languages. So congratulations on the success of the handbook, and thank you once again for being here.
Thank you, Mark. You're doing a great job.
As are you, and I have to admit, I'm extremely impressed with how up to speed you got in such a short period of time. I think you've only been out there about a year, year and a half longer than me, and I'm still trying to scale those cliffs, but you've done a fantastic job.
Yes, the standing on the shoulders of giants is the quote that comes to mind, because yeah, the short track has only come from people who've got a good grip on understanding the problem and explaining them to me.
Well, you've had some excellent teachers then.
I am. Blessed. All right, but I better dash because, yeah, it is midnight.
Thank you so much, Joanne.
Oh, thank you, Mark, and we'll talk to you soon.
Uh-huh. Bye-bye.